From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haven.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside SF.
Coming up, the effort to oust the judge in the Brock Turner case from the bench sparks a debate about what true justice for victims should look like.
I just wonder whether recalling a judge or mandatory minimum laws is going to return this woman to wholeness.
Then we'll hear from the co-curators of an exhibit that envisions an alternative Oakland.
If artists and art can't help us imagine the world we want to live in instead of the world that we currently live in, then, you know, like, there's something really powerful about that.
And we'll hear the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. We're on the move. Stay with us. When Stanford student Brock Turner was sentenced to 6 months in prison for sexual assault, lots of people thought he deserved a longer sentence. They saw a white college athlete let off the hook. Days later, a Stanford law professor launched a campaign to recall Aaron Persky, the judge who sentenced Turner. But not everyone believes lengthy jail sentences provide justice for victims of sexual violence. Some activists say tough sentences unfairly target people of color, and a recall may make judges afraid to show leniency for less serious crimes like drug possession. The Brock Turner sentence and the recall movement have put a spotlight on how issues of punishment, leniency, and justice play out in cases of sexual crimes. KALW's Holly J. McDeed has the story.
Earlier this month, Brock Turner walked out of jail, hopped in his parents' car, and was whisked away. Throughout the day, a crowd of more than 200 people gathered outside, protesting because the judge who sentenced him, Aaron Persky, is still on the bench.
Judge Persky's bias is a threat to the rule of law. And we will continue until he is no longer a judge.
All eyes are on Stanford law professor Michelle Dauber, the face of the movement to recall Judge Aaron Persky. She tells the crowd, Persky consistently favors privileged athletes over abuse survivors. She says Persky let defendants show photos of a victim in a revealing outfit 1 year after she was gang raped.
Supposedly to prove that she did not actually have PTSD from being gang raped.
Dauber says in another case, Judge Persky delayed sentencing a football player who was accused of throwing his girlfriend out of a car. She says Persky wanted to give the athlete a chance to play college football.
We believe that the handling of this case was not lawful, and we need to get to the bottom of this, and we also need to find out whether Judge Persky has done this in other instances.
Bottom line, she wants Persky gone. If Dauber gets 80,000 signatures, a year from now, voters will decide if they want him gone too. People are upset now, but before Brock Turner was ever arrested, there was, on average, one sexual assault reported nearly every 2 weeks at Stanford. Stanford student Stephanie Pham remembers when the assault first occurred, it was little more than a blip in the media.
But besides that, it was really hush-hush. Like, no one talked about it. The administration didn't talk about it.
She wasn't surprised a sexual assault occurred on campus. What was unique was that this case was reported to the police and actually went to trial. For every 100 rape cases reported to the police, only 30 ever make it to court. In this case, Turner was found guilty.
We were like, yes, finally we have justice. We might have justice.
But she was frustrated when he gave Turner 6 months in jail with 3 years probation, when an average rape conviction nationwide is 11 years.
And then it just became so obvious that rape isn't seen as a crime. It isn't seen as this violent offense. It's seen as some drunken, regrettable action.
Stanford law student Emmy Young had the same initial reaction.
He's probably getting a break because he's white and privileged and happens to attend somewhere like Stanford, you know?
But after law professor Michelle Dauber set up a recall campaign within days of the sentence, Young took a step back and looked more closely at Judge Persky's track record.
I really changed my opinion on a lot of things.
She saw that Judge Persky usually follows the probation department's recommendations, like he did for Turner. Plus, she says, some of the cases that so outraged Dauber were made through plea bargains, where prosecutors and defense attorneys agreed on a sentence.
Attributing that result to Judge Persky is just wrong. You know, he didn't have a hand in it.
She thinks the recall sends judges a dangerous message.
That says, you know, you should be careful about how you show mercy to any particular defendant, because if people don't like it, then you might lose your job.
So Young drafted a letter opposing the recall, and 30% of last year's Stanford law grads signed it. She wrote that decades of tough sentences have led to mass incarceration. Charisse Domingo has spent a big chunk of her life helping people of color fight back against long sentences for crimes like drug possession. She says bias soaks every fabric of the justice system, not just judges. In San Francisco, where the population is less than 6% Black, African Americans make up nearly half of all arrests on driving with a suspended license. African Americans are also 20% more likely to be sentenced to prison than white drug defendants. She wants the recall campaign to get angry about that.
I don't see them rallying and getting outraged at extremely long sentences that are being handed down to the kinds of folks and families that come through our doors every Sunday, Tuesday, here in California or in Birmingham and any other place that we're at.
Domingo's a community organizer in San Jose. She remembers reading that Judge Persky considered how prison would impact Turner before he sentenced him. She thinks that if judges looked at poor people of color with that kind of humanity, it would change the whole system.
I would only hope that a judge would consider the severe impact of incarceration on every single person that is facing sentencing where a judge has discretion. I hope that the severe impact of incarceration could be a policy compass.
And she just doesn't think prison sentences will heal victims, like the woman Brock Turner sexually assaulted.
I just wonder whether recalling a judge or mandatory minimum laws is going to return this woman to wholeness. And if we had a justice system that really thought about how do we return people to wholeness, I don't think those options would be there.
Before Brock Turner's sentencing, the victim asked Judge Persky if she could address Turner directly and read from a letter she wrote. We have all been trying to find some meaning in all of this suffering. Your damage was concrete, stripped of titles, degrees, enrollment. My damage was internal, unseen. I carry it with me. You took away my worth, my privacy, my energy, my time, my safety, my intimacy, my confidence, my own voice, until today. More than 5 million people read her letter online. Turner did not receive the 2-year prison sentence the victim wanted. And Michelle Dauber says it was like Judge Persky didn't even listen. That's part of why she started the recall effort.
Taking this to a vote is forcing him to consider it. So I don't know what it would mean to her, but to me, that's what it means. It means you can't ignore her that way.
Judge Persky didn't follow the victim's request, but he hasn't ignored the recall movement. Actually, he set up a campaign to fight it. If voters recall Persky next year, another judge will fill his seat. Many will want that judge to prove he takes sexual assault seriously by handing down lengthy sentences. For others, a harsh judge is exactly what they're afraid of. In Palo Alto, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. A new exhibit at the Oakland Museum of California is trying to address one of the Bay Area's biggest hot-button issues, gentrification, specifically in West Oakland. The exhibit, called Oakland, I Want You to Know, features work from a broad range of West Oakland residents, from school kids to aerosol muralists to documentary filmmakers. It also includes many opportunities for visitors to share their own thoughts through making a poster or writing on the wall. More than 700 people contributed to the making of the show. KALW's Jen Chien spoke with the exhibit co-curators, Oakland artist Chris Trajari and curator Evelyn Orantes, about the conversation they hope this exhibit will spark.
Gentrification is and has been such a hot topic in our region, but it's kind of a slippery concept. So maybe if you could tell me your definition of gentrification. Mm-hmm. Evelyn, would you like to start?
Wow, that is a hard one. As we embarked in this journey of making this exhibition, a lot of what we heard was gentrification is this influx of people coming, some with, you know, there's always the patterns of migration, there's the patterns of change, but there's this other level of an influx of wealth and people that don't always care about what they're moving into. One of our collaborators had a great way of saying it, said, you know, you're a guest before you are part of a community. And it's what you invest in that intention and the actions behind those intentions that make you part of that community.
Perhaps this is a really obvious question, but why did you want to make a show addressing gentrification?
The museum came to me. So Evelyn came to me, and Evelyn came to me with a document that they had been working on.
It's the Neighborhood Community Report. Basically, we worked with the nearest neighborhoods to the Oakland Museum, which is Chinatown, Fruitvale, Uptown, and West Oakland, and wanted to ask how can the museum be a better neighbor and a better resource to our closest neighbors, you know? And so out of that report...
And so that was a survey that you did?
And we did it, about 2 years ago. If you have a moment to look at the report, there's a page that is the snapshot of the four neighborhoods. And when you look at it consistently in all four areas, people are concerned about this idea that their communities are being pulled apart, and that the things that made Oakland beautiful, like diversity and this real sense of history of the people that built West Oakland, and in Oakland in general, is being threatened. And so I think in different ways, each of the different neighborhoods said that. And I think we said, okay, so this is the conversation that needs to happen.
Yes. And how do we structure an exhibition that can utilize hopefully some beautiful aesthetics and some beautiful communication with people to try to create these little conversations within the show that can kind of highlight and amplify these concerns that are happening? You know, but it's not just all the negative, too. It's the wonderfulness of Oakland as well. And what we heard in these wonderful interviews and conversations that we set up was that there was a lot of frustration and some sadness and some anger. And there was a lot of passion and love and this is my home mentality. And so we wanted to try to create a show that had all of those wonderful angles right now. Right now is the key, too, right? Right now happening
kind
in Oakland.
Kind of a portrait of West
exactly.
Oakland in the present tense.
The zeitgeist of Oakland at the moment.
So what we've really created, and this is, again, working with Chris and his vision, was to create this mini community within the museum gallery. And so as you enter, you're entering this, you know, little town really made up of different structures, which are a Victorian, which represents the history of Oakland and this real sense of pride people have that there's so many Victorians have survived in West Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to be even more clear for radio listeners, that this is almost like a theater set that you can walk into.
Exactly.
It's not like little scale models. But
it's immersive. So you can walk into mm-hmm. this kind
an
of
Victorian house.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's not
part
a replica. It's a replica. It's inspired by Victorian. And you go inside and you'll see, you know, there's great video content from one of our collaborators, Alex Gassan, mm-hmm. France. And there's also great photographs by our artist Julie Plasencia, who photographed her whole block, well, most of her neighbors on her block on Chester Street in West Oakland. So you used to really start getting the sense of what makes up a community, who are the people, that individuals that make up a community. Then we have a structure of a loft that's become kind of the icon for the new residents coming in, and we're having a conversation in there through a project you worked on, Chris. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, with the mobile arts platform. For that one, we were talking about the new construction happening in Oakland and what does the future look like of your little block right here that has this new building popping up right next to it. You know, from there we move over. There was a billboard that Defirmary Park made. K Dub from Defirmary Park.
Town yeah. Park, yeah.
Town and Park, yeah. We had the Orbit Room, which was
historic nightclub.
Yeah, historic nightclub.
But also not to Slim Jenkins' place, right?
I know.
Was so the predecessor to Esther's Orbit Room, and actually Esther, who started Esther's Orbit Room, was a waitress for Slim Jenkins, and so that it was this real, again, it's the story of entrepreneurship. And just like the support of a community for African American talent, you know, that goes back to the early 1900s. One of our youth said it the best. He's like, you know, this show's not just to remind newcomers what they're missing if they don't look at what's here, but it's also a reminder to Oaklanders that they're not alone. You know, and I get all choked up thinking about it because it's true. You know, it's just like it's worth the fight.
That was Oakland artist Chris Trajari and curator Evelyn Orantes speaking to KLW's Jen Chien. The exhibit Oakland, I Want You to Know will be on display until October 30th. Find more at klw.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
The dramatic slopings, a nice touch. The floor.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Just to make sure, I'm going to give you another hint. That sound is connected to one of the Bay Area's most beloved writers. Want to know more? We sent KALW's Meredith Hodnott to bring us a bit of literary history from the heart of Oakland.
Today, most people know Jack London Square as a waterside tourist destination. Saturday date nights and Sunday morning farmers markets. But back in the late 1800s, the Oakland waterfront was a very different place. That was when Jack London himself was living here in the Bay Area and writing books that would become embedded into the American literary consciousness.
I wanted to be where the winds of adventure blew, and the winds of adventure blew the oyster pirate sloops up and down San Francisco Bay.
Before Jack London became an iconic writer, he spent much of his early life here, among cannery warehouses, trade ships, and saloons that lined these streets.
In Jack London's time, these would have all been warehouses and, you know, just a very different feel.
Annalee Allen is a local historian, author, and coordinator of the city's Oakland Tours Program, which provides tours for historic sites all over Oakland, including the waterfront. She says it was just before Jack London's birth that the port turned into the active place that he would come to know.
So San Francisco is the main settlement in the 1800s, and over here we were the other shore, Contra Costa.
Up until the mid-1800s, San Francisco was the area's main population hub. The East Bay, with just a few small towns and cities, was known as Contra Costa, or the other shore. But in 1869, just 7 years before Jack London was born, the Transcontinental Railroad came to the Oakland waterfront.
One of the key points about Oakland history is that it was the first western terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad, connecting the East Coast to the West Coast.
The Transcontinental Railroad extended the eastern U.S. rail system from western Iowa to the San Francisco Bay. It also transformed Oakland. the waterfront grew into a national center of industry. The railroad connected passengers and cargo from the east to ferries and ships in the west.
So that's how Oakland grew so rapidly in the 1870s when Jack London was a baby and a young boy.
For Jack London, Oakland was the starting place for many adventures. In one of his first, he went north to search for gold in Canada's frozen Yukon wilderness.
When the world rang with the tale of Arctic gold and the lure of the north gripped the heartstrings of men.
Annalee Allen and I walk into an open area by the docks on the eastern edge of the square. In front of us, there's a squat log cabin that looks a little out of place under the swaying palm trees. It's a reproduction of the cabin where London stayed during long winter nights in the Yukon. It's here courtesy of an area businessman and Jack London fan, who went on an expedition in the 1960s to find the original cabin and brought back the logs to make this tribute. Annalee stoops to peer through the window of the cabin.
So this cabin was here when I was young, growing up and visiting with my parents. And I can remember looking in here and thinking, trying to imagine myself. There are the lanterns there. And there's some old pelts there. It's kind of like Disneyland stuff in a way.
Jack London never struck it rich as a prospector, but he did find lots of materials for his writing career. It was a bitter winter in 1897, and Jack London was just 21. Crowded into a small cabin, he listened in as the other prospectors told tall tales.
Rough jests and rougher jokes went up and down, and great hazards by trail and river were spoken of in the light of commonplaces.
And so young Jack London, you know, writes all this down and keeps it in his mind. It was the dawn of the 20th century, and the rough and ready pioneer prospector days were almost over. So this is the last vestige of it, and he was able to articulate and talk about that in all these stories and magazine articles, and people loved it.
He passed his precious tobacco among them with lavish disregard, and rusty chains of reminiscence were loosened, and forgotten odysseys resurrected for his especial benefit.
Jack London returned from the Yukon and started a prolific writing career. He went on to write dozens of novels, short story collections, and essays. London's passion for words was encouraged here on the Oakland waterfront at Heinhold's First and Last Chance Saloon. Today, Heinhold's is a favorite establishment on the Oakland waterfront, and it also was back in London's day. Just steps from the docks, it was the last chance sailors had to get a drink before shipping off on voyages, and their first chance to get a drink when they came back into port.
A nickel beer, a dime whiskey, you know, Heinhold's was the place to be.
Inside, every square inch of the walls and ceiling is covered in photos, signs, and memorabilia. Bradford Ferris has been drinking at Heinhold's for years, and bartending here for the past two. He points out a framed photo on the wall.
So we have a picture up on the wall of Jack London when he's 10 years old, sitting at the very table at the front of the bar, reading a dictionary that Johnny gave him.
Johnny Heinhold, that is, the original owner of the saloon. He came across Jack London when London was just a scrappy youth working hard jobs on ships and canneries on the waterfront.
And Johnny was a little worried about him, so we really brought him in here, found him a very precocious kid. And realized he had a real thirst for words and literature.
Johnny Heinhold gave London tuition money for university. And in turn, London immortalized Heinhold and the saloon culture in some of his most famous writings.
In the saloons, life was different. Men talked with great voices, laughed great laughs, and there was an atmosphere of greatness.
That atmosphere was carefully passed down through generations of owners and still lives on today.
It hasn't been redone, it hasn't been rebuilt. We're still here today doing the exact same thing we were doing 133 years ago.
The folks at Heinhold take pride in being part of and preserving a little piece of history. As the city celebrates the 100th anniversary of Jack London's death, it's clear that his life and the story of the Oakland waterfront are forever intertwined. For Cross Currents, I'm Meredith Hodnott in Oakland.
Thanks, Meredith. The city of Oakland is celebrating all things Jack London with readings, lectures, and other Jack London-themed events throughout the rest of the year, including a tour of the Oakland waterfront on October 29th. And a big congratulations to Colin Hammond. He's our Audiograph winner this week. Nice going, Colin. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, you'll have another chance to win next week. Here's your sneak listen to the next Audiograph mystery sound.
Please pick up all of our bags and action items at the IFS Baggage Store, which is located next to Bureau 47. Thank you.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you have other mysterious sounds you think would make a good audiograph, give us a call and tell us about them. They can't be gross, though. Just kidding, they can be. Leave a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Well, that's it for us today. Our team includes Josiah Louise Alderate, Bonnie Chan, Jurgen Klem, Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Lucy Kang, Justine Lee, Greer McVeigh, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Ted Muldoon. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. LaVey Smith and her Red Hot Skillet Lickers take the stage at the Royal Cuckoo in San Francisco on Sunday night. Showtime is 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
I've got a man who loves me.